following program is paid for by Little John Financial Services. The opinions and views expressed may not reflect those of Brook Communications, its affiliates, or its employees.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4. Every weekday, News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN brings you local information at 4 o'clock. Now presented by Little John Financial Services. It's David Little John with True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
All right, it is that time of the week. This time of the True Wealth Radio Show on this, the greatest Tuesday you've had
all week.
Joining me in studio today, Mr.
Matt Dixon.
And today we are going to talk about one of my favoritest things in the world. Fees.
Money going in, money going out.
I love
mainly
it.
Focusing on where does the money go out.
Yeah, well, we're going to talk today, but so here's the theme of the show. What's the difference between cheap, affordable, and just straight up getting ripped off?
I like that.
Right?
That's a good setup for
it. It's a good setup. This is the stuff that I think Wall Street does an intentional but also terrible job of disclosing a lot of the time. And so what we're going to do today is we're going to unpack some of the elements of where fees live, how they are sometimes expressed or not really expressed. What exactly are you paying for in the financial industry? Because I've got news for you. Maybe you've heard this before. Maybe you have an economics class. Maybe not. But the expression is noteworthy, right? There is no free lunch.
No. And people right? want to think that there is.
Yeah, everybody's always like, well, but there's this thing. Nope. Somebody somewhere has donated in that scenario, right? If you're not paying for it, somebody else has in one form or fashion. It's either in the form of a direct cost or an opportunity cost.
Yep.
Okay? And that's just how this works. And we're not going to nuance that today. We're just going to acknowledge just how it works.
Well, don't you think that there's been a huge push lately, right? Where, you know, maybe it's not lately. Maybe it's been like the last 3 or 4 years. But where we've seen the industry try and sell a cheap product, right? Like, I think that's kind of how Robinhood really hit the spotlight,
yeah,
right?
I think it started with Vanguard, but it's been trending my entire career, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I started in the very late 1990s when the discount broker was just really emerging, and we had just seen the shift from to what was called decimalization, right? And you're like, what is he talking about?
Mm.
Do you realize that it used to be that stocks were traded in eighths of a dollar?
I remember studying about it, but I
right?
never had to live through
they
it.
They traded in fractions instead of in the dollars and cents that we know and love today. There are still stocks that will trade in a fraction of a cent,
mm-hmm.
which is, to me, just ridiculous.
It's pretty weird when you think about it.
Yeah, it's like that's, you know, $3.43.927.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what? But it you know, it does exist. So anyhow, the math got a lot easier when you didn't have to deal with eighths anymore.
Right.
Right? But we also saw the pathway to cheap really unfold at that point. Right?
It did.
Because now enter the discount broker. Like, do you know, I mean, like a lot of people don't even know what the discount broker is. Do you know what that even means?
Mm-mm, no.
Yeah, I mean, and you're not alone, right? And by the way, I'm not picking on Matt when I say this. I'm just showing you how old I am, right?
Yeah.
Because the discount broker was the idea of like when E-Trade first came out.
Oh.
Okay?
Okay.
So, you could go to the traditional brokerage house, like a Merrill Lynch or a Smith Barney or...
You're saying you know, because people didn't have access to that at one point. Right.
Well, it used to be that you had to go to a full service broker and you needed a person. You had a middleman,
mm-hmm.
right? And that middleman was going to charge a markup for the purchase or sale of one of your investments. Right. So if you bought stock, they charged a commission for it. If
yeah.
you sold stock, they charged a commission for it. A lot of people that are, especially if you've been around a while, still know the term churn, right? Churn was the idea that...
Were they just buying and selling a
buy
bunch?
Buy stuff and sell
yeah.
stuff because it generated commissions for them. Right, so it wasn't a recommendation that was necessarily useful to the customer, but it was useful to the broker. Right, so they used to have the joke you've heard of, like YLD, right? Yield, you've heard that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, YTB, yield to broker.
Oh,
yeah, it's an insider joke, right? But that's a real thing. So we're gonna take let's break into this. Looking today at the internet has given us the ability to see so much more. Right.
But it's a little bit more transparent in a way.
Right. But.
But.
We're so clever in how we hide and disguise these fees, and most people don't know what to look for.
Yeah. And I think that if you want to be a really good investor, you got to be educated on where are the kind of the gotchas, right?
Yes.
Or like, where are those hidden things that you never thought about? Because, you know, a lot of people don't know where the fees are lying. And so if you can get a better understanding of that, you can make better decisions.
Yeah. This happens all over the place, by the way, not just investments. The most common is probably home ownership, where people are like, oh, sure, well, I want to buy a house. It's cheaper than rent. And then they go, oh, wait, but now that I have a house and I also have insurance, and wait, now I have property taxes, and wait, I have maintenance?
Mm-hmm.
And, all of a sudden, that's a lot more expensive than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
And I wanted to buy something, and, oh, there's transaction fees associated, and, well, what about the various utility hookup charges? And, you know, there's just a lot of these little things that add up, and you don't know about them necessarily.
Yeah.
The cost of not knowing is really expensive.
Right. Like, is there a fee to go trade the thing? Or is there a fee for the fund that you're in? Like, there's so many different ways
yes.
that fees are just embedded in the ecosystem.
Right.
That I think we should spend some time today really pulling back the curtain and saying, where are they? And when you understand this, you're going to be maybe not an expert, but you're going to be very informed.
Well, and you're certainly going to have a better idea of what to go looking for.
Yeah, because not one size fits all, right? Like, some people are going to be totally cool with that, you know, basically free version, and it's going to work really well. Some people, maybe the free platform doesn't work for you because you need other things.
Right. So let me start with maybe a generic question that I'm going to ask Matt. I'm going to let you sort of be the proxy for our listeners here.
Okay.
And I go, what do you think are some of the fees that a lot of people hear about? Maybe they don't understand them, but there's just some things that you've heard of. And I'll give you a start off as like, well, commissions are something we've heard of, right?
Yeah. And I think that's a red flag for a lot of people, right? Like, what are you going to sell me? Right?
Sure. Well, yeah. I mean, I think if you hear commission, you kind of immediately connect that word with sale.
Yeah.
Right? Oh, this is a transaction. You're paid for the transaction. So how are you motivated for this money?
Right. So there could be a commission.
Okay.
Not all firms operate that way, though.
True.
Right. So do we want to get into the brokerage side of things and kind of talk about that?
I want to talk about some of the bigger fees first. I'll give you a rundown.
Like mutual fund fees?
Yes, that's a huge one. I think most investors start with mutual funds.
Okay.
Can we help them I want you guys listening to understand some of the standard fees associated with mutual funds and some that you probably don't even realize are in there.
Are we getting super granular
yep.
where it's like front-loaded fees?
So let's start with all mutual funds have operating fees.
Right, because in a mutual fund, you're paying someone to manage that fund, and then they are going and selecting the investments on your behalf based on the stated like outcome or hopeful
investment
outcome.
Objective, whatever
yeah,
the prospectus
of the fund.
Says they're going to do, right?
Yeah, and so if it says that it's a big dividend mutual fund, well, it's probably going to target stocks that pay dividends,
right?
And
incidentally, I use the term prospectus. That is just the contract. It's like the contractual agreement that a mutual fund agrees to play by, right? The prospectus is like the operating instructions that they're
correct.
Follow.
Yep.
Okay. So you're saying there's the operating cost of the fund, okay?
Yep.
And then that's within that is what type of fund and so forth. Talk to me about an index fund for a second. That's a really popular one. What fees are still in or not in a typical index fund?
I mean, index funds, oftentimes there's still a manager, right?
Sure.
It's just the manager's job is a lot easier.
Or the manager's a computer.
Right. And so, yeah, it can be. They're just looking at the index, whether it's maybe the S&P 500, or a lot of people have heard of the NASDAQ. Some people have heard of the Dow Jones. Like, it's going to track the holdings and weightings inside of that index, and it's going to give that to you inside of that fund.
Right.
Or something very, very similar to it.
Right. So I'm going to pick on the S&P 500. That's a really common one. If you were to say go to, I'm also going to use Vanguard as an example. This is not a recommendation, nor is it either pro or against Vanguard, right? This is pretty agnostic information here. We're just using them for our example. But if you were to buy a Vanguard S&P 500 mutual fund, okay?
Right.
What are going to be the typical fees associated with it?
I mean, geez, it could be... Are you talking like what's the average cost?
Yeah.
Is that
what
you're saying?
So the short answer is not much.
No,
right?
I mean...
This is a true index... The manager is basically a computer program.
Probably 0.1% or something
like that. It's going to be very, very low. Now, you maybe, let's do this. Can you explain the concept of a basis point?
A basis point is, to me, I mean, this is going to oversimplify it, right?
Like that's great. Our listeners, let's give it to them easy.
If you have 100 basis points, that's 1%.
Yes.
Right? And so it's just... Think of it like fractions, right? So if it's 50 basis points, it's 0.5%, or 10 basis points is 0.1%.
Right. I think of it as it's pennies, right? So if you have $100 and you have 100 basis points, you get $1.
Right.
But that's the 1%. Mm-hmm. If you only have one basis point, and it's, so I have a mutual fund with $100 being managed at one basis point, it cost me a penny.
My management fee is a penny for the year.
For the year.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, interestingly enough, if I buy the S&P 500, let's just say that we have a 5 basis point fund, meaning it costs us 5 cents per year per $100 managed. Mm-hmm. That's pretty cheap, right?
Yeah.
Like you can get a bigger return on a deposit on a soda can now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So.
Yeah, that $100 isn't costing you a whole lot.
Yeah, it's a really low bar to overcome. So you're getting very, very close to identical performance to the index. Not perfect though, are you? Because you do have a small cost associated. By the way, do you know why there's a cost associated? I mean, you do, Matt, but can you explain to our listeners?
I mean, there's a cost associated with the fund just because there's all the compliance stuff in the background, right? Like, it's got to get listed. It's got to get traded. And there's just layers of cost embedded in having a fund on the market.
It's because it's coming from an investment company, too.
Yeah.
Like, Vanguard... put this thing together. Vanguard's not operating out of charity.
Right.
They're operating at a very low cost, and they're doing so and saying, listen, we're not marking this up much.
No,
you should buy it from us because it's cheap.
I mean, let's be realistic. The Vanguards and the Fidelities, they're really going for volume. Right?
Yeah.
And so if you're doing a ton of volume, you've got to have a lot of people. And what's an easy way to get a lot of people? Don't charge very much.
Right.
Right? Like, how do you think In-N-Out makes a profit on their $5 or $3 cheeseburgers?
Volume.
They have a ton of people in line, and they're just lined up and ready to pay.
Right.
Same thing with your Vanguards and Fidelities. It's the In-N-Out experience.
Mm-hmm.
But guess what? When you go to In-N-Out, there's like 4 things on the menu.
It's true. It's a pretty limited menu. So let's back to our concept here. For all of you guys wondering, like, where am I leading you on this? So Vanguard is the discount offer of, I can buy a really cheap tracking mechanism to buy the S&P 500,
mm-hmm.
right? But there are other versions of mutual funds, and we start adding more fees to them, right? So, for example, do we have fees that are, well, you know, gosh, there are more fees than that. I'm looking at the clock, and I just realized we're already running long.
No, we're not.
Oh, we're totally
already
running long. All right, yeah. We're going to tell you more about the mutual fund fees, but we're also going to grab a break first. So let's do that. When we come back, we will, you know, dig deeper into the fees, and we're going to help you understand. By the end of the show, the goal is for you to understand enough to go out there and be pretty dangerous with it. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
You got True Wealth on News Radio 92.9 FM and 1240. Take you in.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
All right, gang, welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show, where my main man,
Matt Dixon. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And today we're talking about fees. If you want to get caught up, grab our podcast and you can get hooked back up. It's also be posted on YouTube shortly, so you can check back there. But and we're live streaming right now if you want to look in on the studio. Like we've talked about this before, Matt's the good looking one. Yeah, I'm the loud one.
Some days. Okay. David, what are people paying for? They don't really know that they're paying for it, or they don't understand how the payments really work. Like, because nothing's free, right?
We all know that.
There's no free lunch. So where are we spending the money?
I'm going to go through like a laundry list of fees that people need to be aware of. And we're going to go through this fast because I want to get into the things that you're going to care about.
The meat of the show.
How it applies. Okay. We started to talk about mutual funds, and there's a few flavors of them, right? You have no-load mutual funds that are oftentimes things like indexes, right?
Right?
Remember, indexes just means that there's nobody making a decision around it. They're following kind of a recipe or a formula. Okay.
Yep.
So, you know, mimicking another index out there. Oh, the S&P 500. Fine. We'll do what the S&P 500 does. Okay. Then you don't need a manager for that. You just need a babysitter. Right.
So
the computer can do that job. So you can pre-produce something like that pretty inexpensive because you don't need a whole lot of personnel. Right. But you still need the technology and the other stuff. So it's offered through a company. Mutual funds are investment companies, right? And so they're going to charge something for it. And that's what the base operating costs are. So if you've heard of an expense ratio, that's usually what's included in there is the operating costs. There are a couple other things to know about. You have loaded funds. Why do they call them loaded? Because they have commissions built into them. So they're either on the front side, like when I buy it, I pay a commission. Or a more sneaky way to do this is you don't pay a commission up front, but if you sell it early, you have to own it for a certain amount of time, but if you sell it in less time than you're supposed to, they charge you on the way out.
Right? They'll get
so
you one
back
way.
In fees. Yeah. They get you on the way in or they get you on the way out. If you do that, oftentimes the expense ratio is higher. So they're saying you can buy this thing.
Right, because you're basically delaying the payment, and so they want a little interest on it.
Think about it this way. I can pay less for the car, but it gets worse mileage, right? So that's the different trade-off, the way that kind of works. And that's mutual funds. You know, there's some fees in mutual funds that they cannot report.
Like
there's not a way. Actively managed funds, as an example, they can tell you turnover ratios, but they can't really tell you what their trading costs are.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because they don't know what they are in advance. Right?
There's no way to say
what it's going to be.
Right,
it's
because
like,
you don't know if you're going to place 100,000 trades for that mutual fund or if you're going to place 20,000.
Right.
And so the fees can kind of float.
Yeah. Plus, institutional trading often works differently than retail trading.
Okay? Right.
So you and I go and buy a stock in Robinhood or wherever else, and you know you may pay a transaction fee to make that happen. It's not a commission, by the way. We're not in the traditional sense because I may pay $3 for a transaction, and it's whether I buy 1,000 shares or 2 shares. It's the same transaction.
Okay.
It's more like postage,
right?
I have to just pay a standard amount for whatever this is. But those are relevant fees, but you can't, the institutional markets, sometimes they trade directly with each other. So there's not a commission associated with that trade. They're just saying, hey, Vanguard's trading with Fidelity. You guys want a block of Microsoft and we want a block of Google and if we each have it, we'll just swap them, right? So that stuff can happen in institutional markets and it looks different. But that's the way those instruments work is they have built-in fees, some that you can see, some you can't, and you have to kind of be discerning about how you look at it. Now, I told you on this show, one of the things I wanted to do is help keep you from getting ripped off. This is one of those things with mutual funds that I want to encourage everybody to do a little homework on, maybe grab Google or ChatGPT, and you can look this up after class, okay? The concept is something called R squared. Now, you don't need to know how to calculate this. Lots of places will do it for you. But this is a statistical measurement. Matt, we've talked about this before. Do you remember R squared?
Yeah.
You know why it matters?
Yeah. I mean, it's because that number is going to tell you how much of the movement or the performance of your holding is going to be attributed to what we mentioned earlier, which is the index, right? And so if it has like an R squared of like what, one,
it's going to... Well, that is the index.
That is the index, right? And if you were to have like a 0.75 R squared number, that means 3/4 of your performance is coming...
And that's pretty good, by the way. If you had 0.75, no red flags. If you had 0.97, what I would tell you is, wait a second. 97% of your return is the same as the index.
You are the index.
Yeah. I mean, like that 3% difference is statistically insignificant.
Well,
but if you're paying a lot more in expenses, why wouldn't you just get the index?
I'll tell you this. When I do proposals, I'll tell you that most, I'll just use a broad term. Most of the funds that I look at that people are holding are over 0.9, right?
Yes.
Like,
yes. The bigger the fund, the harder it is to have discernible difference in R-squared.
Most people just own the index and they think they're diversified.
Yeah.
Well, and then when you have to break the news to them, they're like, wait, what?
Right, right.
Wait, so you're saying I basically just have the S&P 500 and I'm 2 years away from retirement and I thought I had, you know, maybe a bunch. No, you didn't have a bunch of bonds.
That's kind of different in my mind, right? I'm thinking about a large cap mutual fund that has a R-squared of 0.92, and you go, huh, I thought that I was paying for this great manager, right?
Oh,
and it
yeah.
turns out the great manager is 92% the same as an index fund. But instead of paying 0.05%, or 5 basis points, I'm paying 125 basis points to my manager. You go, why am I paying so much? And the performance is so similar.
Let's
right?
give them let's give listeners a really easy example. What if you just took half of your portfolio and owned the S&P 500, and then you took the other half and you bought the NASDAQ? Most people would probably think that you're really super diversified.
Yeah, and you're not necessarily that diversified. It's all stock. You're pretty tech heavy because of the way they're built these days. I mean, you do own more stocks. Your R-squared would likely change,
but there's a lot of overlap.
There is a lot of overlap in those indexes,
right? Because some of the positions in the NASDAQ are in the S&P 500.
Well, here's the clever thing about R squared. So overlap can be misleading, right? You can actually be diversified and it doesn't help you very much. Let me give you a real life example.
Okay.
Go look at Home Depot and Lowe's. Okay.
Yeah.
They are different businesses, but they're doing such a similar thing.
Right.
Right. They're competing with each other directly. And so what you would have as an investor is diversification, but really high correlation, which means when assets are highly correlated, your diversification doesn't work very well.
Okay? Correct.
That's it. Let me say that again. When asset correlation is really high, diversification doesn't work as well. Right. It's less effective.
Yeah.
So for diversification to be more effective, you need the correlation across the different investments to be lower. Right?
Right.
So that's the idea here. I often use a sports example, right? Snow skis and snowboards are highly correlated. Snow skis and baseballs are not. Right? They're both sporting equipment, but totally different seasons and totally different use cases. They're both sporting equipment. They're in the same marketplace, but they're really pretty different.
Okay? Yeah.
That's the difference between something highly correlated and something that is, low correlation. And so that's how you improve diversification. These statistical numbers are how professionals can sniff that out. Because you could have a mutual fund that owns stuff that's different than the S&P 500. But if it still walks and talks like the same duck, is it really any different?
Right.
And that's the issue here. Sometimes what you're doing is you're paying for marketing rather than efficacy.
That's a good point.
Yeah, and that's
There's
what we're looking for.
Difference.
What are you getting what you're paying for? That's the difference between am I getting something for cheap? Am I getting something affordable? Or am I just getting ripped off?
Right. And if you're paying a lot in fees and you're not getting any diversification or you're not getting anything customized for you and you're just getting the index, what are you really getting?
Yeah, I mean, what happens if you have a phantom index? That's something that bothers me. Is somebody thinks that they have purchased something from a manager, they think they're getting some kind of enhanced return. Maybe they even used to be. That's the other issue, is mutual funds that are really successful have a struggle bus ahead for them, because a really successful fund attracts more investors. More investors means more dollars. More dollars means you have to put those dollars to work in the market somewhere. And as your investment opportunities dry up, you have to start buying more and more stuff just to keep the money working, because you have a prospectus that says you have to do it. Now, what does that mean? It means, great, I've run out of the investments that really made me a great performer. Now I have to kind of buy the second tier stuff that is less attractive, but I got to put the money somewhere. And I start to look more and more like an index as my fund gets bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
And these are just mechanical constraints. Mutual funds can't have controlling ownership stakes. You know, there's a lot of other issues at play there. So they can run into the penalty of great performance. This is also, by the way, why it's really hard to find small cap mutual funds that are still open. The great funds close and they just say, all right, everybody that's new investors, you're out. only the existing investors get to own this. We're closing it to new money because we can't have the inflows.
Yeah. I mean, if it's a small company, you can only buy so many shares.
Yeah. Well, I've talked about the markets. You can be... So this is a fun one. I'm going to drop this point and then we can like take the next break. The point is, institutions, it's hard, right? If you have several billion dollars, you're not going to tiptoe around and nobody's going to notice when you're throwing billions around.
It's okay? True.
You have a few million, you can be a rounding error in the trading volume of a single stock in a day.
Yeah.
Right? You know, go look at how much Microsoft trades in a day. It's millions and millions and millions and millions. It's probably billions per day. You know, you drop $1 million in Microsoft and nobody notices. Right?
Correct.
But you drop $10 billion in Microsoft, somebody cares.
Right.
Right? The market will notice.
Because you just moved the price. You moved the value.
Yes. And so as funds get larger and larger, there's the penalty of like that institutional transparency. It's harder and harder to tiptoe around.
Well, and a lot of people don't realize there's some really, really small companies on the stock market, right? Mm-hmm. That are trading, you know, a couple million dollars a day around. And if you came in with a couple million dollars, you could like buy up all the shares that are available that day for purchase.
Well, think about Warren Buffett. How hard would it be to be Warren Buffett now when you're sitting on hundreds of billions of dollars and you could buy entire companies, but
oh,
you're
easily.
Not allowed to.
Yeah.
Right? You're not allowed to in some cases. And so people say, well, Warren Buffett's got these huge cash positions. What does that mean? And I go, yeah, but how does Warren Buffett now identify another fantastic underpriced opportunity that's going to deliver excess value to his Berkshire Hathaway shareholders at that scale? At institutional scale, like really? Like the whole world's looking for these bargains. It gets harder and harder the bigger he grows.
Mm-hmm.
So pretty remote, which means, hey, you probably should be really patient until the market pulls back a whole bunch and then go buy stuff. Everybody wonders, is Warren Buffett a genius or is he just really patient waiting for his opportunities?
I think patience.
Maybe both, right?
Yeah.
Probably both.
Yeah. So. I mean, that's a whole radio show in and of itself.
But it is
understanding
totally
the mindset
relevant
of Buffett.
To understand that the difference between institutional and retail and what our opportunity set is, but also why... When you're buying mutual funds, you think, I mean, got this huge mutual fund that's got billions of dollars in it, and the manager's been there forever, and go, it's getting harder.
So right? Let me ask you this. We've talked about like the cost of the mutual funds. Are we going to start talking about ETFs at all, or are we going to start pivoting over into like the cost of advice?
Okay, so we don't have to talk about ETFs very much. You know why?
Why is that?
Because ETFs walk and talk alike like stocks.
But they trade on the exchange.
Well, they act, they're mutual fund-esque, but they trade like stocks.
Yep.
And so while there is a cost to an ETF being created and placed on the marketplace, if you're trading those units between other investors, you're really just bearing the transaction costs in that moment. It's when you're redeeming or creating from the institution that the expense ratio is born in those. So they're kind of an interesting animal. They're a little bit of a hybrid. And honestly, that's not where I would be super worried as an investor. It's not that it's irrelevant, but I think the cost of advice is much more important. And given the time we have today, I want to make sure our investors get to hear about it. Our listeners get to hear about that.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Okay, well, we will, but I'm looking at the clock. Let's grab this break. When we come back, guys, we're going to talk about, okay, we know how to start analyzing the expenses embedded in some of these things. Now, what's the cost of doing it myself versus getting help?
Okay.
Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
You got True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240. Thank you, Ian.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
All right, gang, welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show. Matt and I are cruising today because we got to get through all this fee stuff in order to get to the goodies. We already covered mutual funds. Grab the podcast to get hooked up on that. A couple more things that are probably hidden costs that we should talk about real quick.
We were edging into this idea of like, what does that cost come with like the cheap advice. Like, how does that kind of commingle?
Yeah.
And there are some ways that you can, I think, kind of end up in an area where you might have a low cost, but it doesn't necessarily translate over into you have a low risk profile, right?
Yeah, cost and risk are not always correlated. And sometimes, yeah, the cost of something, it's like something is low cost, but it doesn't come with any other guardrails or guidance or even disclosure that is obvious, right? Mm-hmm. Probably the one that comes out to me, that pops out to me the most is when folks do something like a target date fund.
Yeah.
They just kind of set it and forget it. And then they realize like they creep up on something and then time frame's wrong and they've de-risked to the point that they actually now have longevity risk instead. And like, oh, great. You know, now we're sitting in all these cash instruments because we hit my retirement target, but I have 20, 30 more years to live and this thing is no longer outperforming.
Yeah. What was maybe 8% returns has dwindled down to 3 or 4%
right.
for the last 5 years. And so you're missing out on the snowball effect, right?
Yes.
Where it's like, well, I wanted the compound growth, but I accidentally de-risked too early by just being in a target date fund. And the reality is, how many people are in a target date fund? Because if they didn't go in and actually set the investment inside of their 401k, it auto-defaulted to a target date fund for compliance purposes.
Yeah.
And then they wake up at retirement time and they're like, what just happened to the last 5 years of my retirement funds?
Here's another thing that's hard, right? What's hard is that oftentimes, people will not engage in the education around their 401k plans.
That's what
so
it comes down
they'll
to.
They'll set it and forget it, or they'll just kind of throw their hands up and say, it's too hard, I'm not interested, whatever it is. And so they end up with the default investment option. And mm-hmm. the default for most 401k plans is a target date fund based on your birthday. And that's a safety mechanism for the plan sponsor, right? It's for the company.
Yeah.
The company's saying, well, I don't want to leave you in cash because then you could accuse me of not doing anything. So I'll put you in this thing that's linked to your birthday because it's broadly accepted that that's kind of aligned.
Sure.
Okay? But it's not terribly precise and there's no education behind it. And what happens as you approach that date if the date was actually not related to your real retirement?
Yeah.
You know, so you can be de-linked from reality real quickly in that situation.
I think the other big one is annuities, right? Like we can't trash on them completely because there can be a time and a place. But
yeah, there's a use case,
but they're
so expensive
a lot of the time.
For the most
part, that's where one of the things I think Dave Ramsey gets right. You know, because mm-hmm. he hates them. He hates them.
He gets a lot of this right.
Yeah, I mean, he hates them. And here's the reality. I mean, we've looked at a lot of them in our office, right? From you know, stuff that people accumulated before. Maybe they even met us, right? And you look at it and you're like, oh, well, that $100,000 you put in is up maybe 10 grand over the last 7 years. Congratulations. Like, it's done virtually nothing, and it probably could have doubled in that amount of time.
You
so
know,
it's like a $90,000 loss.
I've
it's
never
like,
thought
guys.
About it this way before, and I'm going to take a risk of saying this out loud in real time here. It seems to me like a lot of the time annuities get sold on investment principles instead of tactics. I'll explain, right? Principles don't change. I've used this example before. It's a little gruesome, but it hits home, right? War, the principles of war are unchanged,
mm-hmm.
right? Conquer and win, right? It's going to be, you know, loss of life, and it's going to be pretty gruesome, and you're going to take the territory, right? That's the idea, is that wars are generally over territory and philosophies, and, you know, but you know what's changed a ton in war? Tactics,
mm-hmm.
right? We don't use swords anymore and chariots. Bows and arrow? No, we're using drones and satellites and all kinds of craziness.
Right.
Right. So the principles are unchanged, but the tactics are radically different. The problem with a lot of insurance products is because of the way tax law works, largely you're setting something up for kind of a lifetime commitment,
mm-hmm.
but the tactics keep evolving in the marketplace. Right. I've been doing this 25 years and I can't tell you how many times tax law has changed, how many iterations and evolutions have occurred in the marketplace itself and the way business occurs. It's really very different than when I first started. The principles are not. The
right.
principles of investments are really similar, but the tactics are very, very different today than they were back then. I mean, we talked about the decimalization of the market. Today you have fractional stock trading.
Right.
Right? Fractional stock trading. That didn't exist 10 years ago, hardly.
Yeah.
Right. So this is all really new stuff in the marketplace. You buy an annuity, you're setting really something up that is often like you can't get back out of it. You're making a permanent tax commitment for the most part if you're in non-qualified money when you do it. And
how
if you don't know what that means, you know, see me after class.
I mean, how many of the times have you seen someone buy an annuity and it's been out of fear?
Like, oh, yeah.
You know
it's
what I mean?
Like, why risk to somebody else?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's probably, what, 80% of the reason why people buy annuities. They're just like, I can't take the fluctuations.
Well, how many times have we seen people miss opportunity out of fear, too? Well, I won't buy the S&P 500. I'm going to buy a CD.
Basically, every time someone buys the annuity.
Yeah. Annuities are a lot like CDs. And they're usually sold as, hey, well, why don't you try to, you know, get market-like returns, but with this safety mechanism over here. But then when you look underneath it, it's like, well, yeah, but the safety mechanism costs this much for the insurance premiums. It comes out of your returns, and your returns end up looking a lot like the CDs.
We don't even have enough time on the show today to get into all the hidden fees that can be inside of an annuity that scalp your returns.
Yeah, mortality and expense, the various riders that are in there, whether or not the fees are being applied to the contract value versus the guaranteed value, and oftentimes there's a big gap between the two.
Did you mention the rider fees and all the other things?
I mean,
it's just bleh. Okay, so we talked about that vomit topic. So
tell me how you really feel, Matt.
That's how I really feel.
Okay.
Okay, so what about some of the other ones in here? What are some of the other missteps? How about, like, I don't know, unnecessary taxes? That could be one, right?
Yeah.
Like, you just sell something early, or you don't time the sale of something right, and then you end up with maybe like a short-term capital gain instead of a long-term capital gain.
Yeah, that's a toughie. Don't, like, own it for 360 days and throw in the towel at the end, right?
Right. You're like, you could have waited 5 more days and then saved 20% on taxes, but you didn't know what you didn't know, so you shot yourself in the foot. Now, hobble your way to the hospital.
Right.
But in the financial world, a lot of the times there is no hospital. It's just like, deal with your wound. You can't undo what you just did.
So this is kind of the cost of advice issue, right? I think one of the challenges that we have in the investment landscape is complexity. Okay, there's a lot of moving parts. It's really interesting to me that, like, you have to be such an expert to understand Social Security, and yet we give it to everybody, and expect everybody to be an expert in it. For what? The one time that they're going to actually apply?
Right.
I mean, this is really, there's a lot of moving parts to this. And on the one hand, you could say, well, I'm going to give them the application and then I'm going to take the number that they tell me.
Mm-hmm.
But there's mistakes that happen. Things go wrong. And you also have discretion over when you apply. It's, you know, there's a range of times and how to optimize it and so forth. And it's really kind of tough that we ask people to be an expert in something that's hard to be an expert in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just one piece of the puzzle. Then we look at all the layers in taxes, right? And we just saw new changes to tax law right now. Did we roll out a new class somewhere where all of the American public can go and take a class and understand these taxes? They're not.
No.
Right? Everybody's on their own to figure this out. Right? That part to me is... that complexity thing is kind of the penalty. It leads to fear and it leads to questionable decisions, right? It's not the cost of the investment that usually nips the investor.
Mm-hmm.
Vanguard would have you believe that if you could have gotten the S&P 500 fund, or you could have got this other actively managed fund, and look, one of them is 100 basis points more, you're doomed, right? If you don't get the cheaper fund, look at how much it costs you. And in pure math terms, over a lifetime, they're actually telling the truth. Right.
Yep.
If you have the same performance of two investments, the one with lower fees makes you more money over time. What they fail to report on is the amount of human decisions that can affect the outcome. And oftentimes that price is a distraction from making the good decisions.
Correct.
Right. And there are lots of studies. Vanguard actually did one of these studies. Morningstar had one. I think in 2023, Morningstar said average investor in a 401k paid 0.47% in fees per year. Several of the fees are more than that. But when you look at the Vanguard study before that, so you're thinking, great, look at how much we're paying. Vanguard did a study, or Dalbar did a study. I remember Dalbar did a study in the late 90s. And they said that most investors lose as much as like 3% of annualized return because of unforced errors, bad decisions, and market timing.
I remember that, actually.
Right? They just get emotional and make bad decisions, right? In this case, you're actually better off if you forget. Like, I forgot to deal with it, and I rode through it, and at the end, I came out okay.
Right.
That oftentimes ends up, like the accidental, so like negligence may be a better strategy if you pick a decent fund. Boy, you don't want to say that too many times, right?
Right.
You're telling me to not pay attention? No, I am not. I'm not telling you that. But I'm telling you, paying no attention might be better than looking at it so much that you freak out every time it moves and you sell every time it drops.
Right.
Right. That could really burn you. So anyway, there are some other costs here. I'm looking at this clock, though. We got to grab our last break.
Are we there yet?
We are totally there. So we got like 9 minutes left in the show. We're going to grab a break. When we come back, we're going to try to, you know, just help you sort out advisor or not, robo-advisor. What should I be paying for or not paying for? We're going to try to unpack that. Stick around. I'm All Dave right. Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
You got True Wealth on News Radio 92.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
All right, gang, welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show, where we are...
David's just, buzzing.
Yes. I ran out of time to say all the things.
That's right.
And so they're teasing me about, yeah, sometimes your brain's going faster than your lips. And I'm like, maybe it is.
So, perfect. See, cut that.
You're welcome.
He can use that as a short for YouTube right there.
Okay. Matt.
I'm here.
In the final, thank you. In the final segment here.
Present.
As we are trying to kind of help our listeners, I want to like, let's distill this down. Here's the question that I'm going to try to ask you.
Yep.
When is it a good time for somebody to really look at do-it-yourself investing? And at what point do you think it becomes something where it may be worth getting help?
You know, honestly, if a person does go grab a decent index and they're young and they're just in an accumulation phase where it's like, well, I don't have any money, or I've got $1,000 or whatever, and I plan to throw $50 a month into the market, maybe a low-cost mutual fund or something can play a role in that situation for you, right? Because it's like, well, you know, you're going to dollar cost average your way in over a long period of time, and that might just work out fine for you, right?
Mm-hmm.
So because that person probably doesn't need a lot of planning, right? They don't need a will or a trust, or like they're just not at that point in their life where they're crossing that bridge yet. Not right. that it means that they won't get there, but if things are really basic or really simple, or you know what you want, maybe you're an expert in the market and you can do it yourself. That's okay too, right? The way I look at it is like this. If you said, Matt, here's all the tools. I want you to tear that engine apart and rebuild it. I bet you that with enough time, I could probably tear it all apart and put it back together.
I think you could. I've seen you in action.
But I'm going to tell you this. It probably wouldn't run real good when I put it back together. Like something would go wrong, right? Like a gasket would not get sealed correctly. There would be things that went off. And it might run for a little bit, but I'd probably end up breaking it. Or it just would take so much time that it would have been cheaper for me to like take it to a mechanic and have them rebuild it, right? Like if it takes me 2 years and it takes the other guy 2 weeks, I'm way better off and I'm way financially ahead to just have someone else do it. And I feel like that's kind of the world that we're in. Like, what do you have time for? There's a lot of people that are smart enough to do this stuff.
Oh, yeah. I don't think we're smarter than our clients.
We just spend all day, every day
doing
it.
Yeah, we're specialized. We have all the tools for it. It's what we do.
Yeah.
It's kind of like this, right? Do you want to have a garden or a grocery store?
Sure.
Right? I'm grateful to farmers, not because I couldn't learn how to farm, but because they're doing it for me so I can do other things.
Well, and to be honest, your yard isn't big enough for the beef that you need, the pork that you need, the chickens, the eggs, and all the...
Well, again, tools, including the space, right? It all makes sense. And so we sort of divide up the labor and do different parts of it, right? And you outsource parts of your life, and that's normal.
Yeah.
And so we just don't necessarily think about it that way because we're so used to it that we're sort of, you know, numb to that issue. Right?
Exactly.
But I like your answer, right? When somebody's just getting started and you're in the accumulation phase, there's not a whole lot of planning other than I plan to go to start building something. So I have something to plan with.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So getting started oftentimes is more about just start.
Yeah.
You don't need to pay somebody a bunch of money or anything else. I do think that it is okay if you want to like just have a conversation with a financial planner and say, hey, can you just get me set off in the right direction and send me on my way? Yeah, that may be great.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But you maybe don't need to have them sort of like on call, right? You don't need to be on retainer with a with an advisor at that point, or you don't need to be outsourcing this, right?
Mm-hmm.
At some point, I talk about like really busy people. I have a service that handles the yard for me. I don't mow my own lawn.
You know how.
Yeah, I do. I love the fact that somebody else does this for me because I needed to go do other things in my life. And so it was worth it for me to trade my time that way.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, it gets worth it to have a financial professional for most people.
Right.
Because the moving parts and the complexity and whatnot are just not something that they want to like take their bandwidth and give up in order to do that. If you love investing and you want to be a trader or something like that, that's a different animal.
Right.
Right. But most people don't. And so I think that's the threshold in the accumulation phase in particular. I think when you get close to retirement and distribution and so forth, for a lot of folks, having a professional is probably worth it.
Yeah. But like when you start getting into the more complex things where you got to know, like, when should I take Social Security?
Yeah.
Or like how I've got $3 million and the state of Oregon's going to tax me on everything over $1 million. What do I do? Like,
yeah.
Start bringing in people that know the system well enough to say, avoid this error because that's a $100,000 mistake.
Exactly. There is a point at which having good, sound professional advice very well may make you a lot more than you ever spend on it.
Right.
And I think in most cases, good advice, that's the case, right? You end up money ahead, even though you're paying somebody, because they're supposed to know things that you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're supposed to help you execute on those things, get them done.
Right.
So that's really the point.
Well, and it's a weird one because AI might be smart, but it doesn't know the questions to ask you. Like you can
not
put
so far,
some,
yeah.
Right? Like you can go put something into AI and it'll give you maybe a great response. But a lot of people don't even know what to put into the equation or into the system. And so that's why you hire someone, right? Because they know the questions to ask.
Yeah.
AI doesn't necessarily know those questions yet.
AI, it can still hallucinate and get certain parts of it wrong. There's a lot of elements at play here that we just, you know, tread carefully with. It's a useful tool, but it doesn't even know the questions that it should ask sometimes.
That's what I'm saying,
it doesn't have the intuition like, oh, you meant to ask this.
Right.
And that's the issue, is that it just doesn't, it's not at the point of discernment yet. I think it's going to keep getting better. And so, you know, we'll see, but that day is not now. So we'll watch it with interest. Look, Matt, as we get to the end here, we got final seconds, music's playing. How do they reach us if they need help?
Yeah, why don't you give us a call or shoot us a text at 541-375-0898 or email us at info@littlejohnfs.com.
All right, well, that's it for now. We got to run. Until next time, I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
You've been listening to True Wealth on News Radio, 1240 AM and 93.9 FM and, you know, all the call sign stuff. We'll catch you next time.